Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Politics Uncensored. I'm your host, Ali Milani, here on FUBAR Radio. We have a bit of a different kind of show this week. So rather than having a show on a specific theme, we've got two really interesting guests that are going to be joining me to talk about some really, really critical issues happening around the country. Of course, it is by-election week, as people around the country go to the polls to vote in the by-elections. That includes my old constituency home, Uxbridge and South Ruislip, as well as others. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about Boris Johnson and whether something called Long Boris Johnson exists. We'll talk about the illegal migration bill and Islamophobia in the studio in a moment. We'll be later joined by Carmel Ahmed, a journalist at The Guardian covering international development. He has authored a new book called I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Over Seas and Rivers. We're going to be talking to him about not just the Rohingya crisis, but the international crises happening around the world and what we can do as a country and as different citizens. But before we get to him, we have the week unwrapped. This is the part of the show where we talk about the biggest pieces of news around the country with guests from different spheres in our politics from across the country. And this week we are joined by Miqdad Versi, Director for Media Monitoring at the Muslim Council of Britain. Miqdad, thank you so much for joining me. Can you hear me okay? So we've got Miqdad joining us via Zoom, and we're going to talk about some of the big stories in the media this week. And that includes and starts with the by-elections happening around the country. So the Conservative Party is supposedly suffering from long Boris, a senior Tory MP has said, amid mounting concerns that the party will lose three by-elections this week. On Thursday, which is today, the Tories face the by-elections in Uxbridge and South Ruislip, Somerton and Frome, and Selby and Ainsty. If the party lose all three seats, it would be the first. It would be the worst result for any governing political party since 1968. Steve Bryan, a senior Tory MP and chairman of the Health Selects Committee, told Westminster Hour on BBC Radio 4 that the Tories were suffering from long Boris in Uxbridge. I think everybody in Uxbridge and South Ruislip has been suffering from a very, very long Boris Johnson. I can attest to that personally. He also said that Adam's decision to quit would cost the party votes. Now, bear in mind that if the Conservatives lose Uxbridge and South Ruislip, that would have been the seat of the former Prime Minister. But also Selby and Ainsty and Somerton and Frome are some of the biggest majorities that a governing party could lose since the Second World War. Miqdad, thank you so much for joining us. We have Miqdad Versi, the Director for Media Monitoring at the Muslim Council of Britain. Miqdad, you've done a lot of work specifically around Boris Johnson and some of his controversial comments, particularly the Islamophobic comments that he has made. What do you make of what might be a landmark moment today, and that's the end of Boris Johnson's political career, at least for the foreseeable future?
At least in this seat, who knows? Thank you very much for having me, Ali, and thank you for this opportunity to chat about this really important topic. I think it's going to be really interesting. I mean, what we're going to see, hopefully, is the people of Uxbridge and in South Ruislip sharing their views. And, you know, one of the big things here is, historically, Boris Johnson has been framing himself as someone who's very popular, someone who has been able to change the country and to get, you know, the entire country behind him and to get an 80-seat majority. This is a test to see whether in his area, in the place where he is supposed to be the MP, whether he actually has any popular support, whether in actual fact, in his own backyard, whether he can hold off the Labour likely a victory. And I think actually that's a really good indicator of perhaps a broader current of whether the right in the Conservative Party who say that Boris Johnson should not have been taken out. He should not have been removed from office because it's a democratic deficit in that sense. Let's see what democracy shows.
I think it's notable that so Boris Johnson has not once campaigned with a Conservative candidate, Steve Tuckwell, in Uxbridge and South Ruislip. They haven't had him on the campaign trail.
No,
do you think that's an indication of his popularity? Because Boris has always been a divisive figure. He's always been a bit Marmite. You know, members of the public either love him or hate him. He very rarely gets apathy towards him. But clearly the Conservative election strategy in Uxbridge and South Ruislip has been to distance themselves from Boris Johnson.
And the Labour strategy is the opposite, I guess. So, yeah. So, you know, I think whilst they're trying to make it not about Boris Johnson, everyone's talking about it as if it is Boris Johnson, even if it's not him. And so I think that, you know, we have to see what this demonstrates to us as a, or to the right. And I know that everyone will try and make their excuses in advance. Everyone's trying to manage expectations. Everyone's trying to create their own spin. But the reality here is this is not, this is a place where there is a significant majority, which looks like it might go the other way.
It's I mean,
the
look,
biggest majority of the three by-elections, but it's one that, that actually looks quite likely to go Labour's way.
Yeah, and I, and as many people know, obviously polls are still open, so I won't say exactly how, you know, I won't say for sure which way it's going to go, but people will know that I have a lot of connections to Uxbridge and South Ruislip. I stood against Boris in the last general election. And I would absolutely say I would be shocked tonight if Labour have not taken that seat. And I think that that is the feeling within the Labour Party as well. Miqdad, what I'm interested in, for our listeners who may not know, you have been one of the most fervent campaigners against Islamophobia in the UK in the most recent years. Your work in the Media Monitoring Centre and the Muslim Council of Britain, but also as an individual, you have been, I would say, at the very forefront, I don't think there's anyone ahead of you in fighting Islamophobia in the UK, and I really commend you for that. Boris Johnson has obviously been someone who has been repeatedly had allegations of Islamophobia made against him. He most famously wrote the article where he compared Muslim women to letterboxes, and he has a whole history of alleged racist comments in his past. So I wonder whether you can speak to not the politics in terms of the party politics of it, but could this be a significant moment for the country to move on from this sort of divisive, nasty, racist in some ways form of politics? Are you more hopeful?
I'd love to be hopeful. I really would. And in many ways, we can draw certain lines under what's happened with the Conservative Party when it comes to Islamophobia. If Boris Johnson, if this election means it's the end of Boris Johnson's career. Firstly, I don't think it necessarily does mean it's the end of his career. I think he's always got a way to potentially come back. If Trump wins in the US, who knows what that means for Boris Johnson here and what people might try and create in terms of a narrative about populism and how it remains. So I think that's one thing to know, that it's not the nail in the coffin that some people might be hoping for. But I think the broader question is actually, you cannot solve the problem of Islamophobia within the Conservative Party without acknowledging and actually tackling it head on.
Can you talk a little bit about that Islamophobia, just for people listening, if they have no idea what the scale of Islamophobia in the Conservative Party is? Can you open that up a little bit for them?
Yeah, of course. So the challenge of Islamophobia in the Conservative Party is longstanding. It encompasses leadership. So whether it's Boris Johnson, whether it's actually during Theresa May's time, some of the quite virulent things that are happening from specific MPs talking about Muslims in very, very derogatory ways, sharing stuff from Tommy Robinson and the far right, and actually being quite hateful towards Muslims, whether that's to do with campaigning, like the mayoral election against Sadiq Khan, and Zach Goldsmith election in particular, you know, some of the virulent Islamophobia that was part of that campaign that was almost signposted and supported by the senior leadership. Yeah.
One of the most famous ones of that against Sadiq was the picture of the 7/7 bombings that was placed in an article surrounding that mayoral election. And it was very clear that link was being made to Sadiq Khan.
And it's you know, this is not something that senior members in the Conservative Party were unaware of. I mean, Ken Clark famously spoke about it afterwards. You know, this is a stalwart Conservative, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, talking about how this was a disgusting campaign or a nasty campaign. The words, I can't remember exactly what he used. But it was the same, you know, it was a recognition that this was a racist campaign. You know, senior members of the Conservative Party publicly on Newsnight and other places highlighted, actually, this is not the way that they should campaign. But why was this possible? Why could you? Mm-hmm. Why could the whole party machinery be comfortable with running a campaign that was so clearly trying to get to the bottom of the hate that they want to try and get against Sadiq Khan.
And
about his Muslimness, right?
But it wasn't just a political campaign, was it? We've had data that suggests that these kind of views run all the way through the membership of the Conservative Party.
There's polling from Hope Not Hate, which lays this out quite clearly. A significant proportion of the Conservative Party membership believe that Muslims aren't, you know, have very negative views of Muslims. That could be, for example, saying that there shouldn't be a Muslim prime minister. That could be saying that they think that Muslims are a bad, do not understand the British way of life. There are many, many categories through which you can see that through leadership, through campaigning, through polling, you can understand the virulent nature of Islamophobia within the party. Yeah. And there's case after case of MPs who have had nothing done to them when these complaints have been raised.
Now, and I think so the reason I talk about Boris Johnson is because it seemed like, similar to Trump, his election meant that all of this Islamophobia that, as Saida Warsi said, had kind of passed the dinner table test and was existent in our politics long before Boris Johnson. But when he became prime minister, it seemed like that went to the very top, like it got a stamp of approval. Would you agree?
I think that's true, but I genuinely think, like, you know, the election of when Sadiq Khan won against Zach Goldsmith, that Boris Johnson wasn't prime minister at the time. And to be honest, that was one of the, like, that was a really quite a disturbing campaign, because it was in London, a place which has, you know, which is massively, you know, multicultural, diverse, a large proportion of Muslims in the area. And still it was perceived that is the right thing to do for the Conservative Party to basically say, I don't care about Muslims here. I'm going to be actively Islamophobic in the approach that I take on this. I mean, for me, that was the epitome of, how can that get through all the way through? And remember, during that campaign, the then prime minister at the time made a claim about Imam Suleiman Ghani that he had to remove.
Yeah.
That he had to retract.
One of the things that I think is really important for our listeners to know is I have worked in the political machinery of the Labour Party, and I know the Conservative Party is not that different. In order for these things, whether it's the leaflets, the articles, the messaging to get through, I think people need to hear how many, like you're mentioning, how many levels of approval it needs to go through. Usually there'll be a copywriter at the bottom who will write up the text, and there'll be some sort of political strategy. They'll be given instruction on what kind of direction to go to. That is then seen by their superior. It then goes to a campaign committee who will see it, and the candidate themselves usually will have to sign it off. So there's two or three different check marks in which this can be stopped, and someone can go, guys, there's a little bit racist, right? But the fact that it keeps getting through all those processes means there's a serious problem.
Exactly. And the fact that, and remember, the then Home Secretary at the time, Theresa May, who ended up being Prime Minister, the Defence Secretary at the time, Michael Fallon, he had to pay damages because of what he said in public. David Cameron, the Prime Minister at the time, all three made comments which were outrageous when it comes to Sadiq Khan. And why do they make that? As part of the Zach Goldsmith campaign. So my point is, the entirety of the leadership, so this was a strategic decision that wasn't just made off the hoof by mistake. This was a strategic decision made with support from the entirety of the leadership, or at least in public, the entirety of the leadership, as well as everybody throughout. And you didn't see resignations from CCHQ, from people who thought this is outrageous. You didn't see that. Well, there's not just tacit acceptance. This was endorsement and driving from the center. Yeah. And that's where the problem lies. And what I think the biggest challenge when it comes to the Conservative Party is, there's not really been an acknowledgement that this has been a serious problem. There's not really been a, we got this wrong, we need to fundamentally change to win. And I think that's because it has been a winning strategy, and it's, you know, it's not held them back to talk in this way.
But also, I mean,
the support that you'd expect from media organizations to publicly call them out as much as they could and should.
Yeah, but there's also been, I mean, you've worked with the Muslim Council of Britain for a long time. There has been an active boycott from the Conservative government in working with the Muslim Council of Britain. And I think folks should recognise that the Muslim Council of Britain is the largest umbrella organisation of Muslims in the UK. It's widely seen by most organisations and most Muslims around the country as the sort of voice of Muslims across the UK. Yet the government of the day, the Conservative government of the day, which have massive allegations of Islamophobia, just refused to engage with MCV.
Yeah, and I think it's even broader than that. It's not that they're not just engaged with the Muslim.
Well, we're just having some technical
Muslim
issues.
Voices. We're not the only organization out there. That's fine. Mm. What's a challenge is they're not engaging with Muslims generally.
Yeah.
You know, the Muslims who've been involved in working with, you know, different governments through time, aren't being engaged with. And, and even the softest of the soft Muslims who aren't willing to even stand up on issues to do with Islamophobia and the Conservative Party, even Muslims who literally have nothing wrong with them in any way, suddenly get kicked out because there's one allegation made against them. It is an outrageous and actually dangerous state of affairs where a significant minority of Muslims of our country, Muslims in this country, have no voice when it comes to community relations in a way that many other faiths do. And I think that the way that the government has dealt with this and actually, you know, relations with Muslim communities across the different political policies that are out there is outrageous and needs to change.
So a lot of the work that you've done is not just been in sort of the partisan political space, but it's also been in the media space. Like I said, you were the director for the media monitoring at MCP. A lot of this Islamophobia has infected and in large part is being driven by mainstream media across the UK. Can you talk to us a little bit about the scale of Islamophobia in our media and what kind of impact that has around the country?
Yeah.
Because really, I think if we look at it, the media Islamophobia often drives the political because our politicians are so spineless often. They just regurgitate what narrative the media are running. So can you talk to us a little bit about Islamophobia in the media?
Yeah. Look, case after case you see in the media where Muslims are perceived or create, there's this narrative about Muslims, that Muslims are evil, Muslims are linked to terrorism, that Muslims are anti-Semitic, that Muslims don't like free speech, that Muslims are against all of our values. Again and again, you'll see this narrative. And it's not about one individual story, although you can talk about one in five Brit Muslims have sympathy with jihadis as an example of a lie that was retracted from the front page of The Sun. It could be the front page of The Times talking about Muslims silent on terror. You know, these types of things come up again and again where Muslims are linked to terrorism. And it's just outrageous, right? It is disgusting. And often the authors of these articles find these headlines disgusting as well, but often they can't speak about it or choose not to. But it's not just the most obvious hateful nonsense out there, which creates that narrative and drives hate towards Muslims according to academic papers. Not just that, it's also the subtleties, right? It's also about the fact that there's so much ignorance and idiocy. You know, there was a headline which was saying that Muslims were upset because banknotes were halal. Well, not halal.
Yeah, I remember seeing
and
that.
You're thinking like, do you know what you're talking about? There was a Hindu group who had an issue because there was some cow-related derivative within the banknotes, and there was an issue with the Hindu community. And they somehow decided to make about halal. Why? Because halal sells better. Halal looks... And it was a lie. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were like, millions of people in Europe are there willing to kill us. It was a headline in The Express, slightly different to that, but that message, and it was based on an individual view of one pollster. That you think about this stuff, and it is beyond disgusting that this stuff gets out there.
Now, Dad, what do you think drives it? I'm really curious, because is it just that some of the leadership are genuinely racists, don't like Muslims? Is there a political objective? Is it a case of divide and rule? What's driving this?
So I think that there
because you've met with editors, I assume, and leadership of the papers.
We've met with a number of them. Look, some of them are good, decent people who actually, you know what, if they get talked about, they talk about stuff, they'll change their views. The editor of The Express is someone who, for example, looked at what happened and said, I am not writing a front page attack on migrants again. I am not going to have an Islamophobic front page. We have had Islamophobia in our paper before. It's not happening under my watch. Now, I'm not saying it's perfect in The Express by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that was a decision made by the editor, Gary Jones, and he publicly admitted it in the Home Affairs Select Committee.
And that follows conversations you guys had with him?
These are public, as well as there were after conversations we've had with him. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that we were the reason for it. I think he himself has a very strong view on some of these issues and made his own judgment on them. But what I think is really important is they can make those changes. Look, you can be very right-wing and not be Islamophobic. It's very possible. You can have a left-wing, right-wing perspective and not be Islamophobic. Yeah.
You can also be very left-wing and be Islamophobic Islamophobic. Right. Yeah.
It's not a left-wing, right-wing thing. It's a choice of whether you want to be hateful and structurally racist to a minority community. And I think that what we see in this is there is that potential. However, I think that there are many who ideologically believe that Muslims are a threat in our society. Mm-hmm. Genuinely believe so. And they will, you know, they will speak very nicely. Oh, you're not one of them, or it's not everybody. I'm only talking about that group. Whatever. But yeah. They have an underlying view that Islam and Muslims are a threat to our British way of life. That they are taking over this country in some way. It is their view that is, and they will take that as the narrative that they want to build and corroborate again and again and again. Why? Because it justifies their responses to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps them, because when it comes to the culture wars, what you need is an enemy. And this is a really easy enemy. Why? Because Muslim communities are generally poorer, aren't very well organized, aren't able to stand up for ourselves as much as we could or should do, and are an easy target. And unfortunately, the biggest problem here is that the allies that you'd expect from other people to stand up and say, you know what, this is unacceptable. Yeah. You're not going to get away with this.
Unfortunately, I also think from a political perspective, the greatest currency in a political campaign is fear. And the easiest way to drum up fear in our society right now is those dangerous Muslims are gonna attack our way of life physically, but also ideologically.
And it goes to, you know, that fear is not just the terror, it's not just the ideology, it's also the grooming gangs, it's also the mm-hmm. paedophilia. It's literally the worst things. If you think about the worst crimes you have, you know, paedophilia and rape of young children, murder and terror. These are the things that are associated with Muslims and that as well.
What I'd really urge is, if anyone listening or watching back, and you can listen to this show back on podcast form, is just go on either myself or Miqdad, as the two of us are talking right now, go on our Twitter pages and pick whatever tweet you like and look at the comments underneath. Almost always there'll be some sort of link to grooming gangs or soft on terrorism or apologists for terrorism. And that's the sort of stuff that people get thrown with. And that's what I want to talk about lastly. We've spoken about the sort of environment of Islamophobia in our politics. We've spoken about the environment of Islamophobia in our media. I want us now to talk about the impacts that has on real people. We spoke about Sadiq Khan. I've met Sadiq Khan countless times, engaged with him countless times. Every time I do that, he's surrounded by security officers. No other politician I know has had that. I've, you know, when Jeremy Corbyn was leader, when John McDonnell was shadow chancellor, I engaged with them. I've met with Keir Starmer on numerous occasions, never had security around them. Sadiq Khan always does. When I was standing in Uxbridge and South Ruislip, I myself was the only candidate that had plainclothes police officers on the doorstep with me at our rallies. We received more death threats than I think anyone else. My door had to be reinforced because we were concerned about sort of... arson sort of stuff that they put in the mail and put through your door, because we'd had a threat through the door. This is the real life impacts that are happening. And we've obviously had incidents where Muslims have been killed on the streets. So can you take us through a little bit about the real life impacts? This isn't just stuff on papers and headlines and news and Twitter and other things. People have died in this country as a result of the Islamophobia.
Yeah, very much so. You have, you know, many who have died, individuals, whether it's individuals going to mosque, whether it's someone trying to run them over with a car, whether it's, you know, torture. You've had people who've had their kneecaps attacked. You've had Muslim women, young girls being attacked and abused on the street. You've got verbal abuse, you've got physical abuse, you've got literally hate crime. There's more religious hate crime against Muslims than against any other faith community by three times as much, almost.
It is
out. The level of hate is obviously quite significant. Now, I wanted to try and put another element here. That's not to say that it's not better than many places in Europe. That's not to say it's not better than the US. It very well might be. In fact,
it's not a race to the bottom, is it?
It's no race to the bottom. I want to put this in the real space that it's probably better than a lot of Europe and the US, but it's still bad, and it's really bad. And what some people have this worry that, you know, are Muslims asking for so much? I mean, asking not to have hate crime against one another, not having structural racism, these aren't, you know, big expectations. You know, we can ask for equality and fairness. We're not asking for favors. It's about fairness.
I always find that amazing, right? At least you don't live under Trump, or at least you're not in France under Le Pen. Like, that's some sort of win.
Exactly. I think that, you know, it's fine to acknowledge that. Look, we can stand back and we can acknowledge, yes, it's not as bad as that. But does that mean that in a society that we want to live in, it's okay for women to have their headscarves ripped off from them because they're walking like that on the street? Do you think that Muslim women who are scared to go or at the front of or near train platforms because they think they're going to get pushed because they've seen some videos to showing that. You think that this type of stuff is okay? You think that after a terror attack, when my uncle tells me, "Don't you dare go out in the public space this today," that's something that you think that these are experiences that Muslims all the time across the world, or across this country, will have. Everybody will have an experience like this. Going running, I've gone running, and my friend who was running with me had an egg thrown at him, and he was wearing a thobe. Look, this stuff happens. You know, a friend of mine got beaten up on the train. She, you know, this is a reality. I think there was a poll which said that 90% plus of Muslims know someone who's been attacked physically about when it comes to Islamophobia in some way. I mean, this is a real different experience that Muslims will mm-hmm. have that people don't necessarily understand, appreciate. And until that's recognized and actually actions taken against it, mm-hmm. Nothing will get better. And on this action, this is so key. Right. If you look at the hate crime action plan that the government instituted a few years ago, and you look at how the progress against the different things that it mentioned, you'll see how little was done on Muslim-related issues. Mm-hmm. It's astonishingly bad. It's open. It's in the public space. Money is not being provided in that space when it's given to other faith communities and not given to Muslims. And you think, okay, you know, it's great the government might want to give money to help places of worship, but there's different levels. If you're a certain group, then you get everything. If you don't, if you're a different group, you get less. I mean, it's outrageous. Mm-hmm. Fairness, equality, consistency. It's not that too much to expect.
Yeah.
And we should be demanding that. So, because that's the society that we should be living in and seek to live in.
Miqdad, we're running out of time. I'm definitely going to have you back on because I also want to talk about the Islamophobia and the Labour Party, which we haven't touched on, but I'm sure we'll get you back to talk about that. The last thing, I always like to be a little bit hopeful at the end. You're doing a lot of work tackling Islamophobia. Like I said, you're at the forefront of that. Someone listening in that has been inspired by what you said, whether Muslim or not, and wants to tackle this form of hatred, ready to roll up their sleeves, what would you tell them to do?
Oh, what to tell them to do? Get involved. If you're someone who can be an ally, be an ally. Speak out. Be a supporter. Look at the victims of Islamophobia and support those victims, those who are standing up. It's not about you, it's about how you can support the victims of Islamophobia in the most effective way that you can, through money, through your actions, through your time. Any of those things can make a difference. If you can be an advocate and support of victims and an ally of victims, that's what
specifically as it comes to yourself and MCB, shout out your Twitter, because often when something's put out in the media, you will often encourage people to put in Ofcom complaints and other things, and that we have seen that help, and we have seen articles reversed and changed. So do you want to shout out your sort of your social media?
Mine is at Miqdad, MIQDAAD, and the Centre for Media Monitoring is at CFMMUK. Feel free to reach out whenever you can, and we can try and support you. And if you look at the stuff that we do, hopefully you can support where we can.
Amazing. That was Miqdad Varsi, Director of Media Monitoring at the Muslim Council of Britain, who is at the forefront of fighting Islamophobia in the country. You heard his social media post there, so you can go and follow him and see what they are up to. More power to Miqdad and everyone fighting Islamophobia. I think he so eloquently and passionately put the case of the scale of Islamophobia in the UK politics, in our politics and in our media more broadly. Moving on, as I said at the top of the show, we're doing things a little bit differently today. So rather than focusing on a theme that may have popped up in our politics, as it's by election week, we are going to be talking to Carmel Ahmed, journalist at The Guardian, covering international development. He has written an amazing book, I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Over Seas and Rivers. He's going to be talking to us after this message.
FUBAR Radio presents Access
All Areas. We have the absolute icon, legend, Janice Dickinson.
I'm here.
Do you still enjoy doing reality shows, or do you now see it as more of like a part of your job that you like have to do?
I do really enjoy it. I don't enjoy the actuality of eating fish eyeballs.
Well, yeah, there's that side to Amazon.
Or vagina of cow. Yeah.
But you do like the sort of social side, do you? Like just
the social side was fantastic. Just getting to know people and sleeping with people and eating with people when we didn't really have enough food. Access all
areas. Every Wednesday.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio presents. As handsome as you imagine.
What did you have for breakfast that morning?
Almost certainly a pie.
For breakfast?
Yeah, because we started really, really early, right? At the butcher's. Yeah. We started proper early. That's like 7 o'clock. I would have had at least 6 pies.
A day?
A day.
That is a lot of pies.
No, no, because we sold them at the shop.
That is a legitimate answer to the question, who ate all the pies? Yeah.
From 1 p.m. every Monday.
Welcome back to Politics Uncensored at FUBAR Radio. I am your host, Ali Milani. And today, like I said, doing things a little bit different. In the studio, I've got with me Carmel Ahmed, a journalist at The Guardian covering international development and author of a brand new book, I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Over Seas and Rivers. Carmel, thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your book and why you decided to write it. Bearing in mind that for a lot of our audience, they'll be hearing the word Rohingya for the first time. They'll have no idea what it is or what the situation is. So tell us a little bit about what brought you to write this book and the situation surrounding the Rohingya.
For me, it started the same way. The Rohingya were a people I hadn't actually ever heard of. They're a quite small Muslim minority community from Myanmar. And just over 10 years ago, I saw for the first time a news report about them and was really kind of shocked that I'd never heard about these people. And what was happening at that time was they were kind of facing constant violence from Myanmar, the country they were born in, where they're from, but has rejected them. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s took away their citizenship and has just increasingly kind of ramped up violence and persecution of them in a way that a lot of people describe as genocidal. Mm-hmm. And I just, once I became a journalist, I kind of became increasingly interested in them and just saw that there was this people who lived just across the border from Bangladesh. I was seeking refuge in Bangladesh, often being turned away, and just caught between two countries, caught between Bangladesh and Myanmar, rejected by both.
Mm-hmm. So they're in Myanmar and they're in Myanmar. They're a religious minority in Myanmar.
Well, they were in Myanmar. They were a religious minority in Myanmar. There's still some in Myanmar. But what happened in 2017 is most of them got expelled by a really extreme campaign of military
and
operations.
And where did they go?
And they went to Bangladesh, to where now they're spread in several countries. But the largest amount of Rohingya are now in Bangladesh in refugee camps, which are now the biggest refugee camps in the world.
And they were expelled. So they had lived in Myanmar, obviously, religious minority. And the aim seems to have been, from what I've seen in your work and others, was to really drive them out of Myanmar. What did that include? You spoke about violence. I think it's really important for people to hear the scale of what they went through.
So what it is it's decades of kind of repression and exclusion, erasure. They've been, so since 78 they've faced several military operations, and in 1982 had their citizenship stripped away.
And this is from
Myanmar state. And it's included stuff like conscription to the military, but not to fight in the military, to carry stuff for the military. It's forced labor to build for the military. It's people being taken away from their villages and being disappeared. It's having schools banned and closed, needing licenses to get married or to go to hospital. And as violence has got worse, attacks, burning of homes, massacres, widespread use of rape again as a tool of violence. Being kicked out, and when they've lived in, they mostly live in villages, but where they lived in cities, being kicked out of their homes and cities and put into concentration camps, basically.
And what's the reaction been like from Bangladesh? Because obviously they're Muslims, Bangladesh is a Muslim majority country, but they haven't embraced them from what I understand.
Bangladesh has, because there's been several rounds of this violence for decades, Bangladesh has often accepted them for a period when the violence is at its worst, and then tried to make them go back, using tools like making life more difficult in the camps. Bangladesh's position is that we'll take them when they really need to, but this is not our problem.
Yeah.
There's a thing here that part of what Myanmar says is that they are Bangladeshis. It says Myanmar's a Buddhist country and that these are Bangladeshi Muslims who have kind of come across the border and trying to take over our country. And so Bangladesh is very sensitive about also saying, well, they're not actually ours. So it has...
So they found themselves almost as a people without a land.
Yeah. So in his worst periods, Bangladesh has accepted them, like, to give them safety, but not wanted to, like, have them long term. Mm-hmm. And that leaves them, yes, in that very difficult position where no one really wants them. They have a place where there's centuries of, like, history. And people often talk about, well, who are they and where are they from? I don't think that matters. Like, that's you are trying to put a people between borders that didn't exist 200 years ago or so.
Yeah. And so I think when most people hear Myanmar, they'll think of Aung San Suu Kyi and others. What's the reaction been from her and sort of international leadership? Because she's kind of perceived to be as this very peace-loving sort of hero to many. I think that's kind of been shattered now, but...
Even to the Rohingya for a long time, like, for a long... Like, the grandparents or parents of the current, like, of maybe, like, a 20-year-old now would have fought for her, campaigned for her, wanted her to become the mm-hmm. president. But what they found once she got into power is that she wasn't willing to fight for them. Like, when she initially came to power, there was just this idea of why is she silent on when, like, you have, like, extremist groups calling the Rohingya, like, cockroaches or pests and saying they should be, mm-hmm. like, wiped out. And she's not saying anything. And then when in 2017, when the worst violence happened, actually kind of defending the military mm-hmm. and saying these are like legitimate clearance operations. And then in court, in like when they Myanmar was taken to court for genocide in the International Courts of Justice in The Hague, Aung San Suu Kyi defended the military. She was their lawyer. So... massive, like, disappointment for
yeah, and I think that really was a turning point. Her sort of image of being this revolutionary, peace loving person was kind of shattered. As you began to uncover this, I imagine you traveled out there quite a few times. Tell us about what you saw when you went there yourself.
So I traveled to Bangladesh, not Myanmar itself. I've traveled to the like refugee camps in Bangladesh several times. The first time was actually 2015, before so the camps existed. The camps have existed mm-hmm. for about 30 years. It was only 2017.
The refugee camps in Bangladesh.
It was only 2017 that made them the biggest in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's just, they're just bamboo and plastic. And it's an incredibly congested area. There's no proper sewage or drainage. They're vulnerable to flooding. When you see a storm, you like see people getting up on their roof and trying to tie everything mm-hmm. down because their house can...
So the conditions are really bad.
The conditions are terrible. There's no education. There's really nothing. There's just a million people cramped into a tiny, relatively small area with no resources and mm-hmm. kind of just left there.
And I imagine there's massive health issues as a result.
I mean, but there's really no treatment. Like if you have a health problem, you have like a little clinic maybe to go to and you mm-hmm. get given like... And there were women like who had been raped and had like burns, serious burns, who were given like cowpole. They were given mm-hmm. cowpole to drink. If there are some hospitals, you have to go pretty far.
Yeah.
And you don't have money because you're not allowed to work.
Yeah. And so these are people who are a religious minority in Myanmar. I presume as a result of their religion, ethnic background, they have, like you've described, faced violence, sexual assault, burning of houses, and driven into refugee camps where the conditions, as you describe, are horrible. Why is the international community so silent on this? Because even if we talk about other cases where people have faced massive persecution, violence, places like Palestine, for example, Syria as an example, Yemen as an example, we've all heard about it. But your book is the first time I've come across something comprehensive on Rohingya. Why the silence in the international community?
It's a hard question. They're not the only example of this, but it's a question that comes into my work. It's like, what makes people care? And one thing a senior aid worker once said is that like with Syria, they were fully funded, mm-hmm. their humanitarian operation, because not because they particularly cared about the Syrians, but because they didn't want Syrians coming.
And there were strategic objectives of Syria with Russia and the Black Sea. And
but like with refugees, they didn't want...
They
didn't want them coming here. Rohingya don't have a way to come here.
There's no risk of Rohingya refugees coming to Europe.
They don't have passports at all. And they're only boat, they do get on boats, but they get on boats to Malaysia. You mm-hmm. can't get on a boat to, you'd have to go around Africa.
Yeah.
Or you'd have to like get access through Suez. You can't get on a boat to Europe.
Right, from, that makes a lot of sense. So because there's no immediate risk of Rohingya refugees coming to Europe,
yeah.
the response isn't the same.
Yeah, that's
one of argument. The one of
yeah,
one
because
of the
it's
reasons.
Not it's not just solving the problem. Actual like food rations have been cut twice this year.
Mm-hmm.
People are now, I think the UN said it's average of 27 cents a day is the food now.
Mm-hmm.
Like what people are given for food. There's really no, it's not even just solving the problem. It's now keeping them like alive. Is there's no interest in that. The money has gone down every year.
And so what does the future look like? There's a million people in these camps. I imagine it's not just Bangladesh that they've gone to. You said they've gone to Malaysia. Some are probably not a lot, but some have gone to Malaysia. What does the future look like for them? Is it going to be indefinite, you know, generations after generations living up in these refugee camps? Is there a will to go back to Myanmar, or is there not really a will there?
One of the reasons I did the book is because this how there are people who have been born there, who were born there in 1990 and are still there. Mm-hmm. And they've have all the same problems, and there's lessons there that yes, it looks like indefinitely they could be there unless anyone solves the problems in Myanmar, ensures safety. In Bangladesh, in Myanmar, there's no real people. There are people who have been to Bangladesh 3 times now. They've gone to Bangladesh, been sent back, gone back, like been kind of battered between the countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not that much will to go back. And the problem is with,
why doesn't Bangladesh just embrace? I mean, I know every country embracing a million refugees is going to be controversial, no matter where that is, United States, UK, France, Bangladesh. But you would imagine that Bangladesh might be a bit more accommodating given that they're Muslims and they're fleeing. It's a Muslim-majority country.
It's a difficult question to answer.
Politics.
Politics. It's politics. It's a million. They are also, where they've gone to is a very poor area. There aren't many resources.
Mm-hmm.
You could say, why don't they embrace them and spread them throughout the country?
Mm-hmm.
It's
but I don't think we'd find any country around the world that would
exactly.
embrace a million refugees.
It's not really particular. It's really hard to see the Bangladesh's policies, but I don't think they're like much different to anywhere
mm-hmm.
else.
What should the call from the international community be? Is it a combination of providing safe refuge and legal passageways for Rohingya refugees to get out of those camps, whether that's in Bangladesh or anywhere in the world? I imagine there's got to be some form of justice with the Myanmar state and being held to account for the presumably the war crimes that have been committed against the Rohingya. What are some of the moves that should be taken?
There are one option some people talk about is creating like a safe zone within Myanmar just across the border. Probably quite a far-fetched idea, but possibly one of the only ones that would give them allow them to go back to where they're from, like their villages.
Mm.
Otherwise, somehow to create pressure on Myanmar to restore the citizenship, give guarantees of safety, but that needs a real radical change.
So the future really isn't in Bangladesh, it's on Myanmar.
Yeah, the future is on Myanmar. And I think,
because that's where they're from.
One of the problems is like, when this all happened, actually, prior to that, you'd had like this whole like normalization with Myanmar. And there's an argument that they went too far. Like, they appeased Myanmar too much because they wanted to normalize relations. And there were benefits that like the US and the West in general had from like economically from normalizing with Myanmar. And they were so willing to appease mm-hmm. that they turned their eyes away from like the signs that this was coming.
Yeah.
The only other option really is, if you can't solve that, is other countries need to take the pressure off Bangladesh.
Right.
They need to accept Rohingya as refugees.
That's interesting. So I often do this with guests that come into the studio. Imagine Rishi Sunak is sat in the chair opposite you, or Prime Minister Keir Starmer in the future, maybe, very big maybe, was sat in the chair opposite you, and you had their ear for 30 seconds to a minute to tell them what they need to do. What would you say?
I mean, first of all, put pressure on Myanmar. You need to like put pressure on the way that you'd have on some other countries, on the military, on the generals, and make them suffer. Like, they need to actually not get away with it. But in the meantime, if you can't do that, there are so many Rohingya who are like losing opportunities, and you end up with a generation who, there's this idea of a lost generation. You need mm-hmm. to stop that lost generation and give people opportunity to like have education, to work. And
yeah,
I mean, we've make something.
The thing is, we've seen the capacity to the willingness and availability to do good when it came to Ukrainian refugees. We also saw that in Hong Kong, there was quite a lot of those schemes created for people who were struggling in Hong Kong that, for many reasons we all know, hasn't been reflected to refugees often in the Middle East or in Africa. But that's one of the things that could be done, is to provide, not just to the UK, the international community could come together and spread the sort of the load on across the world, and that would be much easier to handle.
Ukraine's a great example of like what everything that could be done really well. Like, of everything, a lot of what everyone's asked for in other refugee cases, with Ukrainians, they did it, and it shows that it can be done
when the political will is there.
It can be done, and like, these are good examples. Mm-hmm. You should replicate them with others.
And obviously, we've talked about the pressure that the state could apply on Myanmar to stay in its military establishment, the military industrial complex as well. We've seen that being willing to be done in Iran, for example. There's been significant pressures on Iran on its nuclear program, and similar could be done in Myanmar if the situation was seen as serious enough. I want to lastly talk to you about the way that you wrote the book. So talk to us through the process that you went to put the book together. Obviously, it's difficult to write a book on issues that most people haven't heard of. So what was the struggles and the journey in that regard?
I mean, it was difficult. I also started it in 2015, which was a couple of years before most people, anyone, a lot of people had heard of it.
So that's like 8 years that really the book took.
In 2017, when the big massacres happened, a lot of people then heard of it. It was in the news for a few weeks. And there was always the challenge of making people care. And so I didn't want to write anything academic or too, like, kind of, I wanted to make it interesting. I wanted to make Rohingya's voices part of it as well. And so it was many trips and like hundreds of hours of interviews. And I've tried my best to like, there's a few people who are really focused on, and this is their stories. Yeah.
And I definitely think, you know, having seen the book and read the book, their voices come through. It's really quite accessible to read. So if you're listening and you're interested in this issue, interested in international relations, human rights issues, or you're taken by some of what you're hearing, this book is absolutely accessible. You can understand it. You don't need to have a prior knowledge of what's going on. That's all really thoroughly explained. But what I'd also be interested in, obviously, once you write the book, you've got to get publishers to publish it. And this is an issue that some might say, who, what, where? Is that something you faced, and how difficult was it to...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like, during that whole publishing process, there was... And just, yeah, that, like, and also, like, on this case, some people thinking too much has been written, even though not much is written, or, like, is it, like, too depressing? I was told a couple of times, it's too dark.
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing. It a lot of what happens with publishing is not whether it's good enough, it's will it sell. Yeah.
And so... For our listeners who might have been inspired by what you said, wanted to do something, what can they do? Are there charities out there that they can help with? Is it talking to their local MPs to make sure that it's brought up in the House of Commons? What would you say that they can do to help?
Of course, there are charities, but I think as much as funding and money is important, the pressure is important, and pressure to get education to them, to accept people to third countries. It needs to be higher on the agenda.
And they can do that by just simply writing to their MPs. Because I guarantee...
The money that's needed is more than like donations.
I'll tell you something. 650 MPs. I would be astounded if over 100 of them could explain to you what's going on in the Rohingya in even a basic level.
Yeah. And I think that's really what's important, is a political will.
Yeah. And that can be done by writing to your MPs. So the book we're talking about is I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Over Seas and Rivers. How can people get their hands on this?
You can get it from the publisher Hearst's website. This is a code Ahmed25, which if I would suggest ordering several copies of your friends, because it's save on delivery.
But that gives you Ahmed25. 25%. That's an exclusive 25%. For listeners on Fubar Radio. Ahmed25.
But otherwise, I'd suggest like asking your bookshop to order it. They might not have it, but they can get it in like a couple of days. And it's obviously on all the other... Like,
and you're a journalist at The Guardian. How can people keep in touch with your work?
The Guardian website, or like my Twitter, Kamil Ahmed.
Kamil Ahmed on Twitter. Right. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Everybody can get a copy of I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Over Seas and Rivers on Hearst's website and at all good bookstores. At Hearst's website, we've heard exclusively Ahmed25. You can get 25% off for listening to us today. Make sure you go out and get it. One more time, I just want to say a big thank you to Kamal Ahmed for joining us in the studio. I'm going to be joining you all coming back. We're going to go to the Vox Pops, my favorite part of the show, and that's where we go out to talk to regular people about the issues facing the country. And this week, we're talking about Rishi Sunak's university policy, the controversial education policy that he announced over the last week. I'm going to be talking through that and listening to what people said in our Vox Pops after this message.
FUBAR Radio presents Access
All Areas. We have the absolute icon, legend, Janice Dickinson.
I'm here.
Do you still enjoy doing reality shows, or do you now see it as more of like a part of your job that you like have to do?
I do really enjoy it. I don't enjoy the actuality of eating fish eyeballs.
Well, yeah, there's that side to Amazon.
Yeah. Or vagina of cow.
Yeah. But you do like the sort of social side, do you? Like just the
social side was fantastic. Just getting to know people and sleeping with people and eating with people when we didn't really have enough food. Politics
Uncensored. This week we have Natalie Balmain, winner of Channel 4's Make Me a Prime Minister. We do have a serious problem with the standard of our public servants and the behaviour they display both in office and in ministerial office, no?
Absolutely. 100. We're an embarrassment.
Yeah,
we're a nation that once purported to be world leaders. But now with the people we have in charge, we can't even lead ourselves.
Well, we are leading the world in terms of idiots and clowns.
The dating show. Please do. Remember back in the day when it used to be like fashionable, or it was the thing to do when you'd go on Facebook. Yeah. And you'd be like, hello, I'm like in a relationship. What was the other one? It was it's complicated. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it's in a relationship with,
yeah,
or it's complicated. But then what it used to do, it used to pop up on the feed. So you'd be sitting there.
Yeah.
And then in your feed, it would be, I don't know, Jess, whoever is now single. So you'd like that one. Or poke them. Did you poke them? And then you'd give them a little poke.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah. Give a little virtual poke.
Yeah.
Just to go, I see you're single now, babe.
Yeah.
Facebook were great, wasn't it?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. It's Ali Milani again. We've had a really, really interesting show. And I think quite a subtly passionate approach from our guests so far today. Joining me just now in the studio was Kamal Ahmed, who has written a book titled I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Overseas and Rivers. And he's talked to us about what I think most people haven't actually heard anything about, and that is the situation facing the Rohingya, which are a minority community that were in Myanmar, that have been largely driven out as a result of violence, a campaign of persecution from the state, and they found themselves over 1 million people in refugee camps now in Bangladesh, where, as you heard Kamal describe, the situation is really, really horrific. And earlier on, we had Miqdad Versi, Director for Media Monitoring at the Muslim Council of Britain, talking to us about the Islamophobia crisis in UK politics and in our media. When I started the show, I told everybody that I wanted to bring light to issues that are often ignored, some of the passionate issues that exist within our communities that may not be given space in other forums. And that's what this has been about. And the wonderful opportunity that FUBAR Radio gives us is to bring these voices to you. Is to bring these stories to you in an uncensored way so you can hear Kamal describe in real terms what's happening on the ground in one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world that no one is speaking about. You can hear Miqdad Versi on our show talking about the scale of Islamophobia in the media. I can guarantee you, as someone who often does media around the country, that's not something he would be so freely able to do. And so I hope you stick with us in our journey as we bring you more voices like Kamal's, like Miqdad's and others that you will have heard throughout the episodes we've put out. I want to highlight that you can go back and listen to all our episodes on FUBAR Radio on the website, on your podcasting platform, whether that's Apple or that is on Android. But we come to my favorite segment of the show, and that's the Vox Pops. The reason I love this segment of the show so much is because it gives us an opportunity to hear from real people. We go out on the streets, and Kamal's a journalist. Miqdad works with the Muslim Council of Britain. I'm politically adjacent, politician or activist, whatever you want to call me. But none of us are really normal people. And I'm willing to say that now, that people in politics aren't normal people. As God is my witness, they're not normal people. So when our wonderful producers put their sneakers on and go out and talk to ordinary folk on the streets of Islington, it gives us an insight into what is breaking through from mainstream media into the general public. And this week, it was on education. And this is a headline that really stood out to me, not least because I spent 2 years as a student union president. I spent 2 years as the vice president of the National Union of Students. And so higher education specifically is very, very close to my heart. And the story broke this week that Rishi Sunak is aiming to crack down on rip-off university degrees. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has unveiled plans for a crackdown on rip-off university degrees being offered by some universities in the country that do not lead to a decent prospect of a job for students. As the part of the proposal unveiled by the Department for Education, university programs that do not yield favorable outcomes characterized by high dropout rates and limited employment prospects will face stringent regulations. Now, in my opinion, this is what happens when you make an investment banker the Prime Minister. He doesn't know what he's talking about as it pertains to education. I spent many years working with a conservative education minister, higher education minister, and I've never had this level of educational illiteracy when it comes to policy. When someone links an educational degree only to your job prospects, it really tells you that they don't know what they're talking about. This is what happens when bankers start telling the education sector what to do because they are obsessed with this conveyor belt of setting up jobs. But that's my opinion. Let's listen to what the wonderful people of North London had to say.
Do you have a degree?
No.
I don't.
I do. I have a degree in, it's a Bachelor of Design majoring in fashion.
I do. It's in maths.
I've got a degree in physics.
I did a Bachelor of Visual Communications and a Bachelor of Creative Intelligence and Innovation.
So I go to uni. I'm getting in my second year. I do illustration.
I don't think the degree that I did was necessarily great to give me the skill sets that I needed for the workplace, but it was great to get the connections from the university and get the foot in the door kind of experience.
I didn't go to uni. I'm just doing my own thing. I wish I did, but I'm more for creative, so just taking as it comes.
I definitely don't have any regrets, as opposed to the student debt that I do have. I'm not sure if it's something I'd do again.
No, I don't regret going to university, not for one moment. Did I ever use my degree? No.
It's worked out that I didn't need one. I can see why in some sectors you might.
For the most part, it was like entry requirements to do what I was doing. Like the grad jobs that I went into all had some requirements of having been to uni and getting certain grades.
I'm an executive producer at a post house now, and I don't think having a degree would have helped me any more than experience on the job.
So though we have people on the streets of North London being asked what the degree they did do and whether they regretted going to university, now what you will have heard is a lot of people saying, look, my degree didn't necessarily lead into the job that I'm doing, the direct skills, so I may have done English and I ended up in engineering, or I may have done politics and I'm on a radio show and learning how to use radio equipment and media. But the reality is that it is a serious misunderstanding of education by Rishi Sunak. Because education isn't just a training opportunity. It gives people critical skills. It allows people to leave home. It gives them opportunities for critical thinking. It allows them to explore what they love and what they don't love. It allows them to develop taste, understanding. And there are a plethora, particularly in the arts, of degrees that provide people with a whole roundedness, that provide the color to our societal sort of canvas, that don't have job opportunities. So this really dumb-headed approach by the Prime Minister to crack down on universities just because someone doesn't end up in Canary Wharf pushing numbers and getting a job is really, really silly. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't need to work on apprenticeship, because it does. That doesn't mean that we don't need to tackle this sort of, this idea that you're only successful if you go to university. That absolutely does need to be done. But this idea that universities need to be cracked down on for what they call Mickey Mouse degrees is really a reflection on the billionaire's Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and his priorities. That brings me to the end of what I think has been a really, really powerful and moving show. I want to thank all of our guests, particularly Miqdad Versi, Director for Media Monitoring at Muslim Council of Britain. He spoke to us about the scale of Islamophobia in the country. That's something that is obviously very close to my heart and something that I've experienced. So you can go and follow him in the work that he has done. Kamal Ahmed, journalist at The Guardian, joined us to talk about his new book, I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Overseas, and Rivers. And you can get that at Hearst Publishers. He gave us Ahmed25 as an exclusive code for us to go and get 25% off. And I want to thank the producers and the wonderful people on the Vox Pops who talked to us about education. I'm sure we're going to be coming back to this in the weeks and months to come. Thank you to all of you for listening. You can follow us at Politics Fubar on Twitter. We're on Instagram as well at Politics Fubar, and you can follow all of our clips. You can listen back to every episode, from the NHS to education to Islamophobia that we've done today, and a plethora of different guests, including people like Clive Lewis MP, Dawn Butler MP, and Lord Heseltine, who have joined us. You can do that on Apple Podcasts and Android. I've been Ali Milani. I'm at Ali Milani UK on Twitter and Instagram and on TikTok. Thank you so much for joining us. See you all next week. Salams.